welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, January 26, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, our Jack Layton Journalism for Change fellow, Madison Edward Wright, sits down with Ted Rutland. Rutland is an author and associate professor at Concordia University. His latest book, which he co-authored with Maxim Aurelian, is called Out to Defend Ourselves, which shares the history of Montreal's first street gang. Today on the podcast, Rutland and Edward Wright discuss Rutland's research on anti-Black racism and policing in Canada, specifically in Montreal. Here is that conversation. Take a listen.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Ted.
Thanks for having me.
So for our listeners who are less familiar with your research, can you describe your work and what drew you to this field?
Sure. Well, I guess my work since I was a graduate student was concerned with trying to do research that could support social movements. And so I have this sort of belief that research can be useful for social transformation, but generally only when it supports movements that are actually fighting around things. A piece of research by itself doesn't do very much. And when I was living in Halifax, it just seemed very obvious to me that a really essential struggle was the struggle of the African Nova Scotian community against urban planning in and around Halifax. And that was a really long struggle. And so I'm a white settler, grew up in Northern Ontario. And at some point, you know, it became very clear to me that a struggle against capitalism that was also a struggle against white supremacy was the kind of thing that I needed to be supporting. And so I wrote this book on the history of anti-Black racism in Halifax that I hoped and that I think has been useful for communities struggling against anti-Black racism and urban planning there. In Montreal, my research has mostly been focused on the police and, again, the anti-Blackness of police, because, you know, Black communities are one of the primary targets of police violence and police harassment. But it also tries to look at the way that the police are harming other communities and doing research that supports struggles of, you know, unhoused people, people experiencing mental illness, drug users, sex workers, etc., against a very oppressive and violent state institution, which is the police.
Mm-hmm. And so what kind of drew you to Montreal to make the switch from Halifax?
Well, I got a job at Concordia in 2010. And so one of the things is I teach in geography and urban studies. And one of the privileges of that is that you can potentially study the city you live in. And I don't really know how to live in a city and be involved in it politically without nerding out a little bit through research and coming to try to understand the place that you live in. And you know, it's easier to support struggles when they're people you know and the struggles you're part of. So I mostly switched to studying Montreal then and the struggles that seemed the most important to me, especially in terms of struggles for racial justice, were struggles against the police.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I feel like it's a conversation that's been had in Montreal for a very long time. And there's very much a different sides to the narrative. You have the government and the SPVM, the Service de Police de la Ville de Montréal, who are saying that they're understaffed, they need more police officers, we need more funding. And then you have a lot of our citizens and members of the community who are saying, no, we need to be looking at alternatives. And, you know, I think that really does show that Montrealers are ready to have more of a conversation around policing in our city. We do have the highest number of police per capita across Canada. And so I was wondering how you would describe the city's relationship to the SPVM and how that may have evolved over the years.
Well, I mean, there's been a struggle against the police going back to, you know, the formation of the police department itself in the late 1800s. And, you know, prior to the creation of police department, there are things like policing, like you have military officials doing surveillance, you have courts that punish people, etc. And, you know, the formation of the police, courts, and prisons is very much bound up with settler colonialism. And so the attacks through the criminal justice system on Indigenous people their displacement from the island of Montreal in the 1700s, special laws that apply only to Indigenous people, like laws against consuming alcohol, being in a tavern. All of that apparatus is built up to control enslaved Black people who sometimes commit the grave crime of being free, which is a very particular crime that only applies to enslaved people, obviously, and very much tied to the control of working class people when industrial capitalism emerges. And so, in the late 1800s, something like 80% of the people in the Montreal jail were Irish Catholics imprisoned for disorderly conduct or being drunk, So, you're really trying to control working class people, keep them disciplined so that they'll go to work, they won't strike, they won't expend excess energy by, enjoying themselves after work. And that carries right into the present. And when the city really started to change, as cities across North America and around the First World started to change in the 70s and 80s, with the sort of transition away from industrial capitalism towards a kind of tech or knowledge capitalism, and with changing immigration patterns where, there's an end in the 1960s to Canada's white-only immigration policy, cities start to become more diverse, and violence against Black communities becomes much more prevalent, which doesn't mean it wasn't always there. It's just the Black community gets larger. And so quantitatively, there's more violence against Black people. And there's been a struggle against the police. The first time that I found that people were distinctly calling for a paring back of police was in 1979 after the brutal police beating of a bunch of Haitian soccer players in the neighborhood of Saint Michel. So there's ongoing discussion about how to deal with police racism and violence. And a lot of times those discussions, unfortunately, have been centered on things like multicultural training, building relationships with communities, like winning the trust of communities, hiring more diverse cops, et cetera, none of which changes anything, or at least does a positive. And there's always been a discussion about defunding the police, not necessarily with using that term. So since 2020, when George Floyd and Breonna Taylor were killed, we have the second wave of the Black Lives Matter movement, which begins in the United States but carries into Canada. And people in Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, Ottawa, everywhere, they see the connections between the movement in the United States and their own struggles. And so there was a very widespread and vibrant movement to defund the police. In a survey that the city took, 73% of Montrealers were in support of defunding the police. And the city government didn't do it. And so the relationship between the police and the city is twofold. One is that I think there's a widespread resistance to the police in Montreal among people. I mean, we have the lowest level of confidence in the police of anywhere in Canada. We don't have confidence in the police. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we're radical, just means we don't trust these people. We see it as a corrupt and harmful institution. And some of those people who don't trust them would like to see it reformed, but some of them would like to see it defunded, alternatives supported instead. But unfortunately, the city government is dominated by two political parties, Projet Montréal, which is like a city-based, like an urban-based liberal party. And then we have Ensemble Montréal, which is a suburban-based, more conservative party. And so neither of those parties are willing to support anything that has to do with racial justice, anything that has to do with, real social justice, and they're not going to do anything about the police, and they have not. They've funded the police. They've increased police funding more since 2020 than before 2020, and more than anywhere else in Canada. We have this convergence between an urban liberal party and a suburban conservative party that just continues to throw money at the police.
Yeah, I mean, and we saw at the end of 2023 the announcement of the new budget, that now police funding has gone above $8 million. I think we're sitting somewhere around 836 million, was the new budget that was approved. And something that I know you've studied a lot that I think has been part of the SPVN's attempt to kind of, as you put it, become, more integrated in the community is the creation of mixed squads. So can you describe what those are and how the rhetoric around those has been framed to favor police presence?
So a mixed squad is basically a squad where a police officer will patrol or operate alongside someone who isn't a police officer. And usually those are health workers or, people who describe themselves as social workers. And the first mixed squad was created in 2009 to deal specifically with unhoused people. And the context for that is that the beginning of what some people call broken windows policing, is around 2002, 2009. And broken windows policing, you know, it comes out of a terrible article on The Atlantic magazine back in 1982. But it basically presumes that larger crimes like murders, assaults, etc., are the result of letting smaller infractions go unpunished. So the authors of that article talk about like jumping turnstiles in a subway station, graffiti, etc. And so it provides a license for cracking down on very minor infractions, including a whole bunch of laws, bylaws that were created specifically to control unhoused people, like lying down in public, sleeping in public, being drunk in public, urinating in public, etc. Like things that mostly unhoused people are the only people who have to do in public. Like if you have some money, you don't usually, you know, urinate in public. But also there's a tremendous amount of police discretion. So like a white middle class person does like lie down on a sidewalk, probably you're not going to get a ticket. Or like if you're drunk in public, I mean, a lot of people are drunk in public a lot in Montreal, you know, and it's like it's encouraged, you know, it's like a city that prides itself on its nightlife. But like if you're drunk on Saint Laurent at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're not going to get ticketed for public drunkenness. But if you're like lying on a bench drunk in the middle of the afternoon, they can ticket you for that. So there's a lot of outcry, but this huge spike in ticketing unhoused people for things that are not really crimes. And the police responded by creating a mixed squad where we're going to have the police working alongside someone from the health services. And certainly, like, we would imagine that the health service worker would treat unhoused people better. But what happens actually is the ticketing continues, and it continues to increase from 2009 onward, just at a slower rate. So all of that continues. But now you have this other layer of policing where you have a cop working with a health service worker. So it just results in an increase in the amount of interventions faced by unhoused people. And through the 2010s, and especially from 2020 onward, there's a proliferation of mixed squads, almost all of them devoted to dealing with unhoused people in public space. So again, you have the conventional police that are still harassing, repressing, and harming unhoused people. And now you have these mixed squads that are doing the same things, maybe with a little bit less violence, but except in the sense that, like, if you're removing someone from a metro station in the middle of winter and they're there because that's the best place for them, even if you're nice to that person, it seems to me that there's a kind of violence involved in throwing them outside in the cold.
Yeah, absolutely. And you touched on something that I really wanted to speak with you about as well, is the expansion of the SPVM into our metro system. I know that you had attended a press conference that the SPVM held to announce this action, a partnership between them, the STM, and a team in the city called IMIS. It's a mobile social mediation and intervention team. Can you tell me a bit about your reaction when this announcement came out and how you think it's been received so far?
So again, we're adding now another layer of policing. So you mentioned IMIS, which is a squad that looks a lot like a police squad, but they're not police officers. They're social workers, supposedly from a business organization called the Société de Développement Social. That organization was part of many of the mixed squads before they created IMIS. So now you have the conventional police, you have the mixed squads, you have IMIS, which is not police, but acts like the police. Like they don't have guns and they can't arrest people. So like it is better. And then you also have the metro police. So we have four kinds of police all operating in the metro stations. It costs a ton of money. Like we're spending a lot of money on all this policing of unhoused people. And it's like no one seemed to notice the subtle violence involved in announcing this expansion of policing in metro stations at the beginning of winter. It's like, why are we making this announcement now? We're making the announcement because there are going to be more unhoused people in metro stations. That's why, which means that our response to people going inside because it's cold and they have nowhere else to go is to spend an incredible amount of money to throw them outside.
It's kind of hailed as this new step forwards and an attempt to, I think the mayor has used language along the lines of making our city safer, making public spaces feel safer. And I think that really brings the question, safer for who? And that's where we are at the start of 2024. But there's another really big movement happening in the city right now, and that's fighting for Palestine and to free Palestine, to end the genocide in Palestine. And something that has been happening that there's been a lot of reports of is the over-policing and surveilling of Palestinian activists as well as rallies, and just the increased potential for violence at rallies because of the police being there and being the escalatory body that it is. So I know that you are active and vocal about your support for Palestine online. So how do you see the overlapping of these two elements? So fighting for a free Palestine, and then we have this robust police force in the city that is now refocusing their attention on the really important movement we're seeing today.
Well, I mean, like I've always been a supporter of Palestine since you know, since I was aware there was an issue, you know. But when October 7th happened, I was not at all surprised to see that all the people that I consider mentors when it comes to thinking about the police were on the side of Palestine, because it's a very similar logic where, you know, some people were killed on October 7th and like my heart bleeds for them. Mm-hmm. And then Israel, the state, turns this moment of pain into an incredible campaign of extreme violence. Like the only possible response to the pain that some of them feel in that moment, mm-hmm. is to construct an enemy and to eliminate it. And that's the logic of the police, you know? There is harm in our society. A lot of what the police do has nothing to do with that, but absolutely, there are grave things that happen in our cities. The problem is that we continually turn those grave acts into, let's find the person responsible and let's harm them back as badly as possible. And it's not sensible in terms of providing a safe and decent society for everyone. And then when it comes to the police response to protests, you know, they are present at all protests, regardless of the ideology, regardless of the cause. But they have a long practice of dividing protests into three categories, basically the sort of like center to right kind of movements, the more sort of social democratic movements, and then the radical movements.
Okay.
But that distinction is not based on tactics. That distinction is based on like politics. And so the Palestinian Solidarity Movement is viewed as radical, even though the tactics that are used at protests are not radical at all, you know, where people are just protesting, chanting. Every once in a while, there's some graffiti. People aren't even breaking windows. Like, this is not a violent movement in any sense, but they view it as a more radical movement because of its politics. And so there's been a lot more police presence. Fortunately, we haven't had the response that they've seen in Toronto yet, where you have the police busting down the doors of people at 5 in the morning for mm-hmm. having hung some posters on an Indigo bookstore. So, you know, things could always be worse, but certainly they're not an institution that's capable of dealing with the complexities of people are going to have differences on politics around this issue. And mm-hmm. I have very clear siding with Palestinians, but I also think that, you know, Zionists should be able to have their protests, you know. The police are not able to distinguish between everyone's right to protest, regardless of their ideology, and, you know, the ways in which Zionist organizations have been trying to label any Palestinian solidarity as like anti-Semitic and a hate crime. They're just like, they're not able to make those kinds of analysis. And, you know, the state, or like the city government in this case, never wants to provide any guidance to the police.
Yeah.
They just don't care. And they see it as risky to interfere in any kind of way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there might be a little bit of an undercurrent across all of these issues that the police get involved in the city, is that whenever a mistake is made on the part of the police, the excuse that's often used is, oh, well, they're not specifically trained for this. They're doing the best that they can in the situation that they're put into. And while some people have used that as an argument of like, we need to increase funding for the police, I think it really is evidence of we need to be thinking about an alternative, because if the training isn't there, and if this is a system that has institutionalized violence, settler colonialism, racism, how do we reform a system like that when it's so ingrained in the structure of the system? So when it comes to alternatives, and I know this is a big question, but what would you want to see? What would you want to see to keep our city safe and decrease the violence that so many in our community are experiencing at the hands of the police?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, nothing that I'm going to say here is my own idea. And, you know, I learn a lot from movements. I'm part of movements. So the best sort of demands are ones that make sense and are also supported by people who are organizing around these kinds of issues. But I mean, I think one of the things that we need to recognize at the start of the debate, and probably your listeners already do, is that the police are violence workers. Their job is to use violence. That mm-hmm. is their specialty. It doesn't mean they always use it, you know, but their ability to use violence, the fact that their violence is often held in reserve, is key to their operation. And so if the police orders you to do something and you just do it, that's not violent. But the reason you're doing it is because things can escalate. They can harm you physically, but they can also arrest you and throw you in prison, which is a form of violence too. So they're violence workers. So we should really be trying to reduce our use of violence workers as much as possible.
Yeah.
And so where are all the situations where we're calling on the police to respond, where we don't need the police, where we could be doing something else? And, you know, clearly in the case of unhoused people, I mean, we spend a ton of money harassing, surveilling, imprisoning unhoused people. A report from the Union of Quebec Municipalities, which is basically like, this is city governments, mm-hmm. found that we spend $16,000 a year to police one unhoused person. And that includes like court costs and prison costs. Mm-hmm. Well, you can house someone for $16,000 a year. Mm-hmm. It would cost less. And that's just the policing costs. There are a whole bunch of other costs associated with having someone unhoused. Mm-hmm. So it's just like very obviously to me, like the money that we spend on policing unhoused people should be cut to zero. And that money should be sent towards housing people and providing people other services that they need to like live their lives well. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. The other thing is, you know, probably 70 or 80% of 911 calls have nothing to do with crime. They're calls for service. Because we have no one else to call. We can call the fire department, we can call an ambulance, we can call the police. And what many cities are moving towards is adding a fourth service, which would be like a non-police crisis response.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Toronto's moving that direction, Edmonton, Seattle, Eugene, Oregon, Denver, etc. So that's a really easy thing. Like, we don't need people with guns and the power of arrest to respond to calls that are just like, I need someone to come here, you know, like I'm having a conflict with my neighbor, or like there's someone like passed out on the sidewalk. I'm worried about that person. Mm-hmm. So that would be an obvious thing. And then like violence prevention. I mean, we're in this kind of like medieval mindset where we think that the way to prevent violence is to continually find the person who committed the act of violence and harm them, you know, arrest them, throw them in prison. And somehow like either we'll take the violent people off the street, or the threat of punishment will make us not commit violent acts. And it's like that, no research supports that as a logic.
Yeah.
So there's a whole bunch of stuff when it comes to gun violence, gang violence, you know, gendered violence. There's a whole bunch of stuff that works, and we don't invest in it because we believe that if we want to be safe, we should invest in the police.
Mm-hmm.
We need to invest a lot less in the police. We need to invest a lot more in other kinds of things that actually keep us safe.
Well, thank you so much, Ted, for joining us today, and, you know, for sharing your research and your thoughts on the state of policing in Montreal. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for the great questions.
My pleasure.
Ted Rutland, author and associate professor at Concordia University, and Madison Edward Wright, Rabble's Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow for 2023-2024, in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Maddie and Ted. For readers who want to learn more about the issues we talked about today, Ted wanted to encourage those people to check out defundpolice.org, Robin Maynard's book Policing Black Lives, State Violence in Canada from Slavery to the Present, and No More Police, A Case for Abolition by Andrea Ritchie and Miriam Kaba. There are links to each of these resources in the show notes of this episode. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, a federal judge condemned the 2022 Freedom Convoy in a ruling against the Trudeau government's use of the Emergencies Act. The federal government invoked the Emergencies Act in February of 2022 to clear the Freedom Convoy that had occupied downtown Ottawa and several border crossings across the country. while noting that the convoy occupation in Ottawa included individuals displaying hate symbols and harassing local residents, he felt that the federal government had overstepped in applying the Emergencies Act across the country. Judge Richard Mosley, who ruled on the matter, felt that the usage of the act could have been limited to just Ontario, but noted that he had more information at hand to review and the benefit of hindsight, which the federal government did not have at the time. In labor news, 500 civilian federal employees on Canada's military bases in Quebec and Ontario continue their strike action this week. The workers are employed through the non-public funds and have been without a contract since 2022. They are represented by the Public Servants Alliance of Canada and the Union of National Defense Employees. At issue are wages, with some employees making as much as 62% less than other comparable jobs within the public sector. One solution the union is suggesting is a national pay grid to ensure that pay is equitable across military bases. In agricultural news, the National Farmers Union is warning against a recent agreement between Saskatchewan Pulse Growers and Lima Grain Seeds. The agreement is focusing on developing disease-resistant strains of peas and lentils, but the National Farmers Union is objecting to a clause in the agreement that would require farmers to pay a fee for seeds that they retain from their crops that they have harvested. The requirement for farmers to dispose of seeds they have harvested from their crops is due to a patent on those seed strains. The National Farmers Union warns that creating a cost barrier to saving seeds is an attack on seed sovereignty. Seed sovereignty is a model in which farmers are free to save the seeds that they grow. Patents on seed varieties puts control over seeds in the hands of corporations, not farmers. And finally, Rabble Alberta politics contributor David Kleimenhege is criticizing Alberta Premier Danielle Smith for failing to comment on a recent shooting at Edmonton City Hall. On Tuesday, a gunman allegedly entered Edmonton City Hall with a rifle and began shooting. He also allegedly had a firebomb. The man was arrested on the scene and thankfully no one was hurt. David Kleimenhege notes that Smith has yet to comment at all on the incident, but had plenty of time for a recent appearance with American far-right commentator Tucker Carlson and Canadian far-right columnists Conrad Black and Jordan Peterson. The trio were holding a talk in Calgary on Wednesday criticizing Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and the mainstream media. Both Peterson and Black have columns in the mainstream newspaper, The National Post. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.